Two important actions haven't happened yet this week, but are expected to. Governor Brown signing a new state budget and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the Janus case. On Insight, we'll talk about both. The hour begins with State Senator Holly Mitchell, who is the chair of the California Senate Budget Committee. She'll highlight some of the spending priorities in the new plan. Then the anticipated U.S. Supreme Court ruling on Janus versus AFSCME. It didn't happen today, maybe Thursday. The president of the California Teachers Association will join me to give the CTA view of a decision either way. Later in the hour, two of the four playwrights whose work is featured in the new Comedies Festival this weekend at B Street Theater will join me, and you can vote for which of the four plays, as long as you see all four, make it to the main stage next season. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Governor Jerry Brown has a $200 billion budget deal on his desk. He has until Friday to meet the California deadline to sign it. State Senator Holly Mitchell is the chair of the Committee on Budget and Fiscal Review, and she's joining us from the Capitol in Sacramento. Good morning, Senator Mitchell. Thanks for joining us again on Insight.
Good morning. As always, thank you so much for having me.
So $200 billion is, let's just say it, an enormous number. What does the number, just from the get-go, mean to you about this state?
Well, the number, for me, means that it's a reasonable, responsible budget that includes investments for the needs of California and Californians. I think it reflects both investments in human and kind of physical infrastructure, as well as responsible savings in multiple rainy day savings accounts. So it's a good budget.
All lawmakers want a budget to move the state forward in some way. So in that sense, from your view, what's the headline about this budget? What's the headline about how the state moves forward?
Ooh, that's a great question, because headlines suggest just like focusing on one kind of topic, and it would be hard for me to do that. I think the headline is it's balanced. It represents two historic actions, a historic high investment in K-12 education, a historic investment in our effort to eliminate childhood deep poverty by making the first-time investment in increasing the CalWORKs grants in over 40 years. But it also reflects the highest level of savings on record. So I think the fact that we made history with this budget would be an easy kind of tagline.
Some of the, by the way, nice answer on that question. Some of what's been written about this is that there was frustration for healthcare advocates. They were looking for more money to reduce the cost of health insurance premiums, expand access to Medi-Cal. What about some of what didn't happen in this budget?
And they're absolutely right. We heard that as recent as yesterday in a full budget committee hearing, where we were hearing trailer bills that will help us operationalize the investments on the healthcare side. The trailer bill that tells us how we're going to spend Prop 56 dollars. And the advocates stepped up, and they're absolutely right. My colleague, Senator Ricardo Lara, gave an eloquent floor speech last week, a painful one, where he brought residents who were in the gallery from all over the state, you know, hardworking California residents who don't have access to what I believe everyone should be entitled to, access to healthcare services. So we did not, in the final deal, expand access to undocumented Californians. We did that for children last year. It was the hope of both the Assembly and the Senate that we could expand it to both younger undocumented residents and seniors, 64 and older. This bill, the budget bill, does not include that coverage.
I do want to get a little deeper into an aspect of childcare that's important to you. But before we go there, one of the comments from Senate Leader Tony Atkins is that in talking about the budget, she said, "We've recovered from the darkest days of the recession, and now the state's fiscal outlook is the strongest it's been in a generation." I think she's speaking especially to the rainy day fund, but are you as optimistic and sure about where we are, in spite of California having a volatile economy, as what she just expressed in those words?
I absolutely am. And the pro tem and I came in together. We were both elected in 2010 and elected to the Assembly together. And we both painfully remember those first couple of budgets that we had to vote on when we were still in the cut and recovery kind of mode. And I think this legislature and this administration, this governor, have acted responsibly. There have been years where we didn't invest and reinvest in areas where I would like to have. But I think when I look back over the 8 years, we've made strong incremental progress. Sometimes there have been really tiny baby steps. For example, you talked about childcare, our investment in early care and education. We've made progress compared to the $1 billion cut the state experienced in 2008. We've made incremental progress. And so I think the pro tem is absolutely right. Again, thanks to the voters, thanks to the vision of the governor, we have now multiple rainy day funds that this year we maxed out in terms of what we can under the Constitution contribute towards in them. So I think I agree with her. It looks good.
You have highlighted that this budget reflects the highest investment in K-14 school funding in history. There's also money in higher education. And yet, I know you're following the governor's race, and the candidates for governor are talking about how much we need emphasis on education in the state, how far behind California continues to be, how lacking this administration has been in its attention to education funding, including lawmakers in their decision making. So what's that disconnect all about?
Well, I think there's candidate speak and then there's governance. And I fully appreciate the candidates raising these issues. I think whoever is governor come January will be fortunate to inherit a healthy California economy and a healthy state general fund, which this current administration did not inherit 8 years ago. And so it will then be up to them to do what they think is best with the pot of gold that will be left to them by the current administration, healthy rainy day funds. And it'll be up to them to work collaboratively with the legislature to figure out what's next in the best interest of California as a whole.
I'll have to remember to ask the next governor if he feels like he has a pot of gold in looking at the state budget.
Well, what he will not inherit, and I can say he since we're after the primary, what he will not inherit, if you'll recall in 2011 when we all took the oath of office, Governor Brown convened a summit, if you will, where he brought in leaders from across the state. There were mayors and members of boards of supervisors from across the state at the convention center across the street from the Capitol. And he showed an inverted bar graph that projected out several budget years. And at the rate we were going, without direct action, without the ballot initiative that allowed us to extend the sales tax revenue, without some clear actions taken by both the legislature and the governor, we were going to continue to be in the deep, dark recesses of being below sea level, if you will, right, in terms of the state's income. And so the incoming governor will not have that outlook to have to manage.
You're listening to California State Senator Holly Mitchell. She's joining us from the Capitol. She's been the chair of the Senate Budget and Fiscal Review Committee since December of 2016. She's the first African-American to chair that committee, and she represents Senate District 30, which includes Culver City and much of Los Angeles. So let's get to what I alluded to, this specific effort toward Black infant health and the programs surrounding it. This became important to you, as I understand it, when you explored what other states were doing and how much more California could be doing than it was. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, I think my personal history with the Black Infant Health Program in the state of California goes back maybe 25 years. It was a Sacramento Bee article that introduced me to a local organization here in Sacramento, the Birthing Project. And the Sacramento Bee article, literally 25 or 30 years ago, I hate to admit, focused on the disproportionate number of Black infants who were dying. The Black infant mortality and morbidity rate in Sacramento County was higher than compared to any comparable county across the state of California. And the county public health department, the state public health department really wanted to know why. And so that was my first introduction. I was a young staffer at the time here in the building, staff in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. And so it was an issue that I followed up on based on California's alarmingly high rate of Black infant mortality.
It is true, though, that other states are handling Black infant health differently than California and funding it differently, right?
They are. And a part of what we were able to do, working collaboratively with a local organization, the local foundation, the public health director in my home county of L.A. County, is we looked nationwide at a number of model programs that are research-based that are showing significant improvements in the infant mortality rate, a number of interesting models that are both kind of social support, linked with federally qualified health centers. So we looked at a variety of these new models and for the first time in many years provided a significant infusion of dollars into the state's program to allow counties and nonprofits and health providers to partner and seek out grants to be able to try these new models here in California.
You've set up nicely how to describe what the grants are doing, the increase in funding, and then if you would connect that to how that can shift statistics, I think we get more of a picture of the connection, the money connection.
Yeah, well, it's been amazing as we've looked nationwide at these policies to look at how many states and municipalities have been able to significantly decrease their Black infant mortality rate. You know, currently it's 2 and 3 times that of our white counterparts. And so some of these models literally have been able to cut their infant mortality rate in half, if not more. And so we're hoping to use these models here in California and see what some of these practices do. There are 46 states across the U.S. that are doing some of these evidence-based programs, and we wanted California to step up to the plate and join them.
To get specifically to the outreach, I found it intriguing that the main question that's posed to people who might interface with these grant programs is, do you want to become pregnant in the next year?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Talk about why the question is posed that way and how it can be answered and then what happens next.
Well, that was a great model that was actually introduced to me by the director of the public health department, L.A. County. And it really is a clinic-based program that really helps. The current model comes from South Carolina, and it really helps engage the woman, if you will, and her health provider in a proactive dialogue about her intentions to make sure that we help improve her own health status prior to becoming pregnant. And so if the question is posed to me and I think about it and I tell my health provider yes, then my health provider can be much more proactive in helping me manage my weight, helping me manage my blood pressure, helping me manage whatever health stressors that I may be currently experiencing, quite frankly, as a Black woman in America, that compromises my ability to deliver a full-term baby. And so it's a proactive way to engage with my healthcare provider to really help me plan better.
Senator Mitchell, can you be specific about the connection that's been established between Black infant health and racism or racial discrimination?
Well, you know, I think scientists and doctors and community folks, lay advocates, have really spent decades trying to understand why African Americans are so vulnerable to lower birth weight and really losing their babies. And there's a growing consensus now that racial discrimination experienced by Black women across their lifetime makes us less likely to be able to carry our babies to full term, which is tragic. Because when we look at the data, it's Black women, regardless of their income, their class, their educational attainment, those typical indicators for poor health outcome don't seem to be the driving force around our Black infant mortality morbidity rate. And so we had to look beyond that. And so what does a low-income Black woman, a middle-class, upper-middle-class Black woman have in common? And that is the fact that she's Black. And that she experiences stressors throughout the course of her lifetime that impact her physical body, her physical health. That's what the new research is pointing towards. And those are the larger systemic issues that we're going to have to address if we want to truly impact this embarrassing rate. There are, quite frankly, third world countries who have better birth outcomes for the larger segments of their population than California or the U.S. does with regard to black women.
Back to the question then to the women, if it is, do you want to become pregnant in the next year? And the answer is no. Then what's the pathway?
Well, I think that, you know, that's just one of the program elements that they have found successful. And it really is a way of engaging in a conversation about chronic disease management. And so we have to talk about stress. We have to talk about blood pressure. We have to talk about how we manage our physical wellness in a society that attacks you on a daily basis. Lots of conversation right now about race in this country and those who inflict it and those who are subject to the isms associated with it. And so even if you don't answer that question, yes, I intend to become pregnant within the next year, it is still an important realization between the woman and her healthcare provider about how the greater society ills can impact your wellness.
Fatherhood and the partnership of parenting does play a role in here, too. I don't want to leave that out of the equation.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And there are fatherhood and partnership initiatives that support engagement in this process. And so, again, research shows that positive child health outcomes are connected to engagement with fathers and partners in a broader community. And so at this point, there's not a statewide program to coordinate the current rather patchwork fatherhood programs county by county. And so we're hoping that through these resources that can be accomplished.
And to the resources specifically, it's a new pot of $8 million. Is that correct?
Yes, it's $8 million on top of the current annual budget for the state program, which is at $4 million general fund. So we've doubled the current investment to create this unique opportunity to model new programs in California, new research-based progressive programs that we see in other states have made a significant difference. And we're hoping this infusion of new dollars will bring forth the same outcome for California.
So that means that we need to talk about this again. That means that we need to track whether there are results and how soon. And I don't know what the expectations are, but I do want the follow-up.
I agree, and I think it's a broader conversation, again, around access to health services and what impacts a person's ability to be well. Mm-hmm. You know, the California Endowment did an amazing kind of public research project that tracked your life expectancy to your zip code.
So,
you know, our broader conversation about what impacts our ability to be healthy, you know, recognizing that violence is a public health issue. Those are things I hope we can continue to have the conversation, because birth outcome is a consequence of a lifetime of health and wellness.
Thank you so much, as always, for your time. I appreciate this conversation, and we'll look forward to the next one.
Thank you so much.
That is California State Senator Holly Mitchell from District 30 in Southern California. She's the chair of the Senate Budget Committee. You can find more coverage of this year's pending budget plan. And of course, we'll let you know when the governor signs the deal. That will be at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio, I'm Beth Ruyak. From the U.S. Supreme Court this morning, no ruling on the case known as Janus versus AFSCME. On the phone with us is Eric Hines. He's president of the California Teachers Association, which has 325,000 or so members in the state. Eric is in Minneapolis at the moment for the annual National Education Association Assembly. And Mr. Hines, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Are you reading anything into the court waiting at this point to announce this decision?
Well, you know, I think if I had a crystal ball like that, I would be, I'd probably be famous. No, it's really hard to tell. And as we know with the Supreme Court in the past, it's not a decision until it's a decision. And we'll just have to wait until tomorrow to see, hopefully tomorrow, to see what that decision is.
Some people say that the bigger decisions are put off to the very end or even close to a weekend to kind of quell any big reaction that might come.
That may be it. You know, like I said, it's almost a cottage industry trying to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do. But like I said, it won't happen until it happens.
Court watchers are, though, counting votes now that there are 9 justices again, and you are there with the NEA in Minneapolis. What's the buzz, but I really want to know, what's the expectation of this decision?
Well, you know, we're not so much focusing. Well, you know, the decision's going to happen, and whatever the decision is, you know, there's really very little thing, you know, little we can do about that. What we can do is really focus, and what we've been focusing on in California as CTA is still improving education for students, and that means improving funding for our schools, where we're still, you know, ranked 42nd, 43rd, even with the 5th largest economy, focusing on providing good professional development for students, and making sure that we can attract and retain the best and the brightest, since we're facing a teacher shortage in California. That's where the real meat is happening. And all of this other stuff with Janice and is simply it's big, but it's side drama. And we're going to continue, regardless of the way the decision turns out, we're going to continue to focus on our students in California.
To be more clear, the Janice case is Mark Janice, an Illinois government employee, versus the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Council 31. And the court is going to decide whether agency union agreements can be invalidated under the First Amendment. So Rebecca Friedrichs brought a similar case to the court, which ended in a 4-4 tie 2 years ago. A rehearing petition was denied. Do you see this case, the Janice case, as a similar, though smaller, case?
Well, yes, it is. It is almost identical to the Friedrichs case, and that's no mistake. This push is not coming from a grassroots movement of teachers or workers. In fact, it's being funded by the National Right to Work organizations who are trying to defang and defund unions, and now it's public sector unions. And so it's really an attack on every worker and every family in California and across the country, and trying to weaken our voice to get together.
Let me take that a step further. Do you see it as an attempt to defund Democrats, Democratic organizations?
Well, you know, when we recommend it, and I can speak for California, and I know also nationally with NEA, we recommend many Republicans. It's really about the educational issue and their educational platform. If they support providing good public schools for every student in California, you know, or in the country, regardless of the zip code they live in, we will support them as a candidate. And we've supported many Republican candidates down the road, as well as Democrats.
So my question, Eric, was really about kind of pulling this apart and saying, how much is this a union case versus how much is it a politically motivated action case? And maybe less in the specific candidates that are supported, but a division of parties and platforms?
Well, when we look at what this case is really about, and first of all, it's about paying fair share fees. What simply the case that they're trying to overturn about 40, you know, 41, 42 years ago or so, Abood versus Detroit Unified School District, really said and has been the established law for 40 years that you can't be forced to join a union. Nobody can. But you benefit from being part of that collective bargaining unit where there is collective bargaining. You get all the raises, you get the job protections, the union still has to protect you if you're treated unfairly, and you should pay a fair share for those services that you receive and the benefits you receive. That's what's really at stake here. And they couch it. Nobody pays for political things that they don't want to. We have a very open process for deciding who we're going to support as candidates and what positions we support moving forward in education. Now, in California, we have an almost 800-member delegate body called our State Council of Education, which meets four times a year. These are local delegates that are elected by local teachers to represent them, and they set the policy and who we support and all of that. They start with doing the interviews for candidates that are running for office, all viable candidates. They make all the policy decisions. They decide how all the money is spent. It just keeps going on, and it keeps being debated the entire way up the process. But it's that 800-member body, or almost 800-member body, that actually makes our decisions. And those are representative of every state in or every part of our state in California. And again, they meet four times a year. Nothing comes out of my mouth that hasn't been vetted and debated through policy by that body.
You're listening to Eric Hines. He is president of the California Teachers Association. He is speaking to us from Minneapolis today. I think you know that Rebecca Friedrichs of the Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association was on the show last week with guest host Beth Duncan. Part of her position was that most teachers appreciate local association, but they feel they're forced to support state and national interests. She broke it down in a money sense of the $1,000 a year dues. The majority goes to CTA. A small piece goes to NEA, and then an even smaller piece, she said $157 of that $1,000 went to the local. And that was part of her key issue. So how do you respond to that specific point?
Well, I mean, first of all, each the dues level that teachers pay in what's called the unified teaching profession, local, state, and national, are set by that body at that level. So the amount she pays to CTA is determined by our state council through a formula, and that's the CTA portion.
But is it true, could I pause you for a moment, is it true that no matter what that amount, the breakdown always is the majority goes to CTA, the next level goes to NEA, and the smallest level is local?
It depends on what the local decides. Usually, each local is different because it's locally decided. So the amount she pays to her local or any teacher pays to their local is decided democratically through a representative body, sometimes through a member vote. They use different processes at the local level. CTA doesn't influence what she pays in her local
each school district,
what anybody pays. So
each school district makes that decision?
Each local union, which
local
is usually
union.
So in Los Angeles, they decide how they want, you know, how much union they want to pay to their local to keep their local business, to be able to do things like that. At the CTA level, it's, again, our state council that makes that decision through a democratic process. They've decided on a formula how that works. And where I am now in Minneapolis, where our national body, the Representative Assembly, which is almost 8,000 members that are locally elected, including myself, to represent local teachers, the NEA sets what level dues it decides to pay. So they're all decided separately and depending on the need of that local. Although the money, of course, you know, gets supported back and forth depending on what the work that needs to be done.
Right. Her basic position, and I do want to give you a chance to respond to this, is that collective bargaining in the public sector is political. Do you disagree with that?
Well, you know, I think anytime democracy is political, and anytime we as workers decide to get together and have a collective voice to that extent, you know, everything we do is political. But it's collective bargaining, and our dues are funded through it's voluntary dues that we pay from our salaries, and everything we do is designed. You know, when we talk about, like, you know, say Sacramento politics, everything that we do in our classrooms, every decision we make, and I'm a teacher. I'm an elementary school teacher in Pittsburgh, which is in Northern California, mm-hmm. In Contra Costa County, and everything we do as teachers is decided through politics. I mean, everything we do. But to say it's inherently political, and I think is a talking point of the National Right to Work people and the extremists and billionaires who are trying to fund this effort and take out the voice, or at very least weaken the voice of working people to be able to get together. Let me tell you why this is important. We don't have to look any further than the last election primary in California. When we look what money was spent to support a candidate who supported Antonio Villagrosa, where they threw in almost $30 million to support him, and not through a grassroots effort of people who wanted to express their, but a billionaire, Reed Hastings, wrote a check for $7 million. I, as a teacher, and there isn't a teacher in California that can do that. The only way I can have my political voice is by choosing to get together collectively with my colleagues and through a democratic process decide who we're going to support because of their educational stance, and then we're going to support those people in the best way possible. And so I take a little bit from my check, they take a little bit from their check, and we together decide how we're going to support the candidates.
I think there's a bit of a parallel there, because in you saying that you objected to Reed Hastings and the bigger charter school advocates with money stepping in and influencing the race the way they did, it sounds like what the teachers are saying, with the majority of their dues going to state and national interests, that they feel like they're being shifted to represent people or platforms that they don't want to. So do you see a parallel?
Well, I didn't say I objected to him spending $7 million. What I said was that I can't spend $7 million, nor can any worker in California spend $7 million. And the only voice we have is through our collective joining together in our collective union to decide how we want to be able to influence policies that benefit our public schools and that benefit our students. I think that Reed has, can spend whatever he chooses and however he chooses. But if I have a different stance, and so do my colleagues, then through our policy and through our process, then we can also collectively decide how we want to do that. And I think that's part of the democratic process. And it's not all the work we do. I mean, the when we say all the money, that goes to CTA, we also do a lot of work around professional development for teachers. We have a project where we partner with Stanford University, and it's called the Instructional Leadership Corps, and actually training local educators to do professional development in their local districts. We work through our Institute for Teaching to foster innovation and give mini grants for teachers to do some very exciting things. We're working very strongly to help develop a good process. We're doing some exciting things in education in California.
Mr. Hines, can I jump in, though? Because if the fees become optional, all these great programs that you're listing, then what happens to them? What procedurally changes depending on the court's ruling?
Well, it depends on how the court decides. I mean, if they decide that in Janice's favor, then rule against the working people and families, then in fact those fair share payers then we will stop the day after to comply with the ruling, stop collecting fees from those fair share payers. By the way, what those fair share payers just pay for is the amount that is part of that collective bargaining that they benefit for. Their money that would go to political action that is considered non-chargeable is all rebated back to them.
Mm. I was going to say, which is a likely scenario with Justice Gorsuch expected to take a position against the union in this case. That's just a suspicion at this point. We don't have a ruling from the court. And I think it's interesting to think about what the ruling on this case might have been if Merrick Garland had become a justice on the court. And I don't know how deep in the weeds you get in the justices and their politics, but can you explore that a bit with me?
Well, it's hard to play the what-if game. We could certainly go very deeply into that. My concern now is what affects the students that I teach. And that's the concern of every teacher in California now, how this ruling will affect how we the collective voice we have in affecting the students we teach, and that's the primary thing. And we've been focusing very strongly on making sure that every student we teach, you know, if we go through preschool through graduate school, over 9 million students. That's a lot of students that will be affected by this, and by teachers losing or having their voice weakened, weakens our ability to advocate for those students. And now, especially now, when we're doing things like with thanks to Governor Brown and his, you know, local control funding formula, and building local accountability plans together with communities, focusing on that and things that actually work to improve schools and improve student learning, attract the best and the brightest to the profession, that's where we should be focusing. This whole political side drama, we know where the money comes from for this, and we know the agenda. They're not even being very, very coy about it. They're simply saying we want to defang and defund unions because they give money to Democrats.
Well, to reflect on the history you mentioned, though, it is true. The issues have been similar and argued in different ways, but over 40 years. The reason I bring up the justices is that one of the major differences is who's sitting on the high court.
Absolutely.
Who has a vote here?
Yes. No, yeah, you're absolutely right. But it's like just playing the what-if game. I certainly, in my head, you know, sometimes when you're sitting around talking what could be and what could have been, unfortunately, we have to deal with what is. And what the reality is, because that's where the real impact comes.
Okay, and one last question then. If the fees become optional, does CTA need to organize and roll out some sort of campaign to convince teachers across the state to keep paying the fees, position and maybe become more transparent about those fees so that there's a different level of understanding?
Well, like I said, our dues are determined through a democratic process and are actually quite transparent to our members. You know, if all they have to do is look, it's you know, for how we do that. If we remain relevant to our members and they understand the things we do, you know, they understand the need for a collective voice. It's not, you know, these are people who care about, you know, they care about our students, they care about their profession. Yes, they care about salaries and health benefits, but as altruistic as you may be, you can't go into teaching if you can't afford to feed your family, and if you can't afford to pay the rent or pay a mortgage or things like that, or if you stay in the profession for 30 years but you can't depend upon a reliable or dependable retirement, or if you can't, you know, pay health benefits. There are the people in the state that workers in the state who work primarily to pay for health benefits. I met a school secretary who's working part time, and at the end of the year, which she did, or the end of the month when she got paid, she handed the check back to the district and added more money just for benefits for her family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just wrong. And if we want to create an environment where we want to improve our schools, we need to do the kinds of things that improve our schools, and that means a good, strong, stable collective bargaining environment. That's why the Attorney Generals of California and the United States at the time argued in favor of and against the Friedrichs case at the Supreme Court when Friedrichs was there. It brings stability to the system, and we also know that it improves education. And if that weren't the case, we could see what happens in Wisconsin and what the chaos that's happened in Wisconsin. We would see Mississippi and Louisiana at the top of the rankings, but they're not there. In fact, I would argue exactly the opposite.
You are speaking to the much bigger conversation, and when we have specifics from the high court about this ruling, I think we'll be able to go into much more detail about what's next and what are the implications for every state. So, Mr. Hines, thanks so much for your time today, for stepping out of the conference in Minneapolis. We're glad to have you on Insight.
It's entirely my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That is Eric Hines. He is president of the California Teachers Association. As soon as that ruling comes from the high court over the next couple days, we will bring it to you. And you're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Steve Milne is standing by with more news. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Beth. CAL FIRE has deployed more than 230 people to fight the Pawnee Fire in Lake County. Since Saturday, the wildfire has scorched 11,500 acres. It's burning northeast of Clear Lake Oaks. More than 1,000 people who live in the Spring Valley community remain under mandatory evacuation orders. Some of them are staying at an evacuation center that the Red Cross has set up at Lower Lake High School. CAL FIRE says the blaze is being driven by erratic winds and low humidity. Lake County has been particularly hard hit by four destructive fires since 2015. And checking on other fires burning in Northern California, the Stoll Fire in Tehama County, west of Red Bluff, that is 60% contained at 268 acres. The Flat Fire in Tuolumne County that has burned 163 acres. It's 65% contained. And the Horse Fire in Calaveras County near Copperopolis is 95% contained at 80 acres. Yolo County supervisors are considering whether to accept more than $2 million in additional money from the federal government to continue housing troubled immigrant children. Today, supervisors will discuss whether to use the money to hire more employees at its juvenile detention facility, 3 months after the county's probation chief recommended ending the program. County officials say the teens are not among those separated from their families under a recent Trump administration policy. As many as 24 teen immigrants housed in Yolo County are charged with committing serious crimes or are considered a threat to themselves or others. And two long-lost sisters had no idea they shared the same parents until a DNA test revealed it 6 months ago. 78-year-old Sacramento resident Beverly Meyer and 83-year-old Joyce Reischer of Seattle met in person for the first time last week with a family reunion held Saturday. Reischer's granddaughter, Melissa Berry, discovered the two women had the same parents last summer after researching her family genealogy. Meyer was adopted, and her seven siblings had no idea she was born. Follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah.
I'm still thinking about that one. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. B Street Theater's Midtown location is new this year, but it's also launching something new called the New Comedies Festival. New. It's celebrating and showcasing new comedies. I have two of the playwrights in the studio with me, Brian Daniel Oglesby. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
Daniel.
Hi.
Hi to everybody in Davis, because this is some of your stomping grounds, right?
Yeah.
And Lila Teitelman is here. Hi, Lila.
Hi.
You're
thanks.
From far away.
I am. I'm from the East Coast.
All right. Welcome. You have a specific city in the East Coast that you live
yes,
in,
though. Yes, I live in New York, there but I'm go. From New Hampshire, so all over the East Coast.
So they're here to talk about their plays. Associate Artistic Director Lindsay Birch from B Street is also with us. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having us.
So this festival is possible because of the new location, right?
It is. And, you know, it's something that we conceived of, myself, Buck, Jerry, Dave, the artistic staff, about 2 years ago, I would say, at the old location. You know, as you probably talked about with one of us over the times you've had us on, play selection and filling a season with a diverse amount of plays that are contemporary works, new works, classics, is the hardest part of our jobs. And this was really created because we had a slot in our season that we said we want to fill this with a comedy, a new work, but we can't find the right piece. We had read so many plays, and so we said, why don't we just support the creation of that work? And the new space has really made this possible. Having Brian and Lila and Robert Casely and Jim Christie are the other two playwrights, having them out, having all four plays being rehearsed at once. We also have like a hospitality room where the actors and playwrights can all gather and socialize, and that would not have been possible at the old location. It was too small, and also we always had plays running, so that kind of eliminated completely one of the spaces that could be used.
You ended up getting more than 50 submissions.
We did.
So, Brian Daniel, when you saw this opening up and you know about mm-hmm. the new B Street Theater, did you have a play in mind? Did you write something new?
Yeah. I've been working on Small Steps, which is the one that we're reading for a couple years. I wrote it actually while I was in town for the summer. I generally live in Austin, and worked on it last summer at a new play development festival in Portland, and then in New York at the Lark, at Playwrights Week at the Lark. So it's something that's been in the hopper for a couple of years now, and so it just seemed to fit.
And there were blind readings, so nobody knew that there would be any kind of a connection.
Right.
Hence, we have Lila from all the way across the country. Same question to you about seeing Here's an Open Festival, and what do you have in the works, and what intrigued you about it?
Right. So my play, Baby Cakes, is a very new work. I've never seen it on its feet at all, and I've only heard it read once with a group of actors. And I was sort of hesitant a little bit to submit it because I didn't necessarily think of it as a comedy. It's sort of like darkly funny in a way because it's about a lot of grief and anger and sadness. But it's done with these like really comedic characters and their relationships are sort of fun to watch unfold. And so I sort of was just like, you know, I'm going to take a chance on this and maybe someone will read it and find it hilarious. I guess that's what happened.
Here you are.
Yeah.
So let me fill in a little more. Brian Daniels' Small Steps is about Skip. What's the essential storyline of Skip?
Well, the sort of elevator pitch for it is Skip Powers is sick of online dating and volunteers to go to Mars just to get off this planet. And they say, yeah, sure, you'll do. And so he
goes
to Mars.
Because men are from Mars, right? Isn't that? Women are from Venus. That's the rest of that, if you don't know. Okay.
The famous book.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we get his story as an Earthling on Mars.
That is not... That's a little bit, it's a little bit more complicated. Mostly it's really about the sort of things that he's leaving behind and he's looking towards. So it's a lot of his story. So Act One takes place largely on Earth as he is getting ready for this trip. And at the end of Act One is him launching to on the spaceship Atlantis to head to Mars.
Okay, in both of these plays, we have stuff that people are leaving behind and sad about that becomes very funny, right?
Yeah.
So, Lila, tell me about Helen.
Right.
We talked a little bit about it, but she's in a support group.
Yeah, so the story is that Helen moves to this new town in Pennsylvania, and she finds this support group of women who have all had children die.
It's a comedy.
It's a comedy. As I said, it's a dark comedy. So she doesn't necessarily fit into this support group, but she sort of doesn't reveal all the information so that she can have this group of new friends and mothers that she feels comfortable with and can sort of explore their grief because she has her own set of problems and her own set of sadnesses in her life. And she feels in some weird way that she fits into this group. And so when that's revealed, it sort of gets a little messy.
So that's Baby Cakes by Lila Teitelman. And it shows June 28th at 5 and June 30th at 2. Small Steps by Brian Daniel Oglesby shows June 29th at 9 and June 30th at 5. The two other plays involve a pair of identical twins, a romance, and a couple deciding whether or not to have a second child. The fun part of this, Lindsay, the pitch that I like is go see all four and you get to vote.
Yes. So if you see all four of the plays, they're all being read twice. So you have two chances to see each one. Then you can vote. And we are fully committed to producing one of these four plays in our 2019 main stage season, which we just did a private announcement of. We'll be publicly announcing on July 1st. And so the fun thing is that next year, the piece that's selected from the festival will be running, the full production will be running during next year's festival. So a little bit of a nice...
Did you hear Brian Daniel? He was like, he didn't even know that.
So there's news there. So we're very excited. If you see all four readings, then you'll receive a survey and you can vote on which maybe your favorite, but which one you would most like to see produced. Because you might think, wow, I'd really like to see someone go to Mars on stage. And that's really exciting to me. Or this was my favorite, so I really want to see that produced. But we do want to make sure that it's fair in the sense that if you're voting, you see all of them and you make an informed decision because we're really excited about all of these plays and we hope that, you know, maybe in the future we might eventually produce all of them. So it's an exciting time.
So it is the New Comedies Festival at B Street Theater this weekend, June 28th to July 1st. Lila, you're here for the weekend, right?
I am, yes.
Playwrights Conversation, Brian Daniel, you're here too. Mm-hmm. So you all get to visit with each other, visit with the audience. You're sitting in the back of the audience listening to the reaction too, right?
We are.
So good luck. I appreciate that you came in to talk about the play. I want to celebrate the new work with everybody. And Lindsay, thanks a lot. What a fun idea.
Thanks so much, Beth. Thanks for having us.
We'll post a link so people can find out more. And with that, it's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Dravel, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. Back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.